C'est un grand plaisir de continuer donc avec, maintenant en traversant les Himalaya, avec Craig Clunas, qui va nous présenter une communication sur China and the limits of early modern visual culture. Craig Clunas, c'est un des historiens de l'art chinois les plus connus aujourd'hui dans le monde, et surtout pour l'époque Ming. Il est l'auteur de nombreux ouvrages, par exemple « Empire of Great Brightness, Visual and Material Cultures of Ming China »,« Screen of Kings ». Il a aussi, bien sûr, publié des ouvrages qui vont au-delà de l'histoire de l'art strictement dit, comme « Superfluous Things »,« Material Culture and Social Status in Early Modern China ». Ça fait vraiment un grand plaisir de l'avoir ici. Et malheureusement, il va vous parler en anglais, mais il veut quand même discuter en français si jamais. Et...
Bon, oui.
Bon, on verra. Bon, merci. Merci.
On verra. Merci. C'est un très grand honneur de me trouver ici et je suis désolé de parler en anglais. So all material culture has a visual aspect. And all visual culture exists in a material form, or at least has a material support. So for me, the visual and material terms are not separable. This is true of those visual and material testimonies to global history that go back way before the early modern period, or stand on its threshold. Those objects so rare, they have their own names, like the Helge Buddha, 6th century Indian, but found in a Viking site on an island in Sweden's Lake Mälaren. The Tazza Farnese, Hellenistic Roman, but at one point in the possession of Akkoyunlu rulers in Iran, whose court artist drew it. The Katsanellen Bogen Bowl, a modest Chinese pot set in sumptuous mounts to commemorate its acquisition, probably in the Holy Land, by its German aristocratic owner. So by now it's a cliché to think of blue and white porcelain as the first global brand, and the whole tradition of playing spot the Chinese object, peering into the background of works like Jan Brueghel's The Sense of Sight, is a game with sharply diminishing returns. There's a long tradition within Western art history of studying the exotic imports in the princely Kunstkammer, whether it be the Chinese painting in the Tyrol, the African ivory in Florence, or something like the Royal Danish Kunstkammer, where things Chinese, Brazilian, or Gurkha were assembled indifferently under the label of Indian, the early modern equivalent of non-Western. Long predating the visual term, there is a history longer than we might imagine of global historical comparisons, often flat and totalizing, as in the 18th century Irish writer Oliver Goldsmith. But the now current idea of encounters also has a long history. And in the case of China, it goes back to well before any visual turn in historical scholarship. In 1935, there appeared a volume which shares some of the features of the comparativist enterprise of, for example, the great art historian Bernard Berenson, but by an author who shares none of his fame. I.V. Puzina is not a name to conjure with, and this émigré Russian art historian's 1935 book, La Chine, l'Italie et les débuts de la Renaissance, is now a largely forgotten curiosity. The title tells you all you need to know about this curious work, which is the most consistent and certainly the most lengthy attempt to argue for an East Asian point of origin for developments in European painting in the 14th and early 15th centuries. Given the importance of these developments, centering on the canonical names of Giotto and Duccio to accounts of Western art, the hypothesis is a bold one. To put it bluntly, for Puzina, Chinese influence caused Renaissance art. But significantly, this isn't claimed by him as an original idea, rather as an old topic now being given a fuller treatment. I quote, "The question of the influence of Chinese painting on the painters of the Trecento has often been discussed in the literature, but it has never been the object of a dedicated study." End quote. In the text which follows, Puzina joins a full historical exposition of Catholic missions to the Mongol Yuan dynasty, ruling in China down to 1368, to a series of formalist comparisons between Italian painting and Chinese painting, and thereby arrives at the conclusion that, quote, at the beginning of the 15th century, a number of artistic innovations appeared in Italian painting. These innovations coincide with the traditional art of Chinese painters of the same period. In his final sentences, he is unequivocal, quote, Chinese culture was imitated by the Italians of the 14th century. It still exercised its influence at the beginning of the 15th century, as we have just seen. But this influence is not limited to the imitation of Chinese painting. It is much wider, and this confirms one more time our conviction of the influence of Chinese art on the painting of the Trecento. Just to pause for a moment, in case anyone is wondering. Puzina's argument is pretty much nonsense, and his Chinese influence on Trecento painting is as fantastical as, if slightly more honestly argued than, the Chinese visitors to Florence. In a more recent popular example of this sort of diffusionist bad history, Gavin Menzies' 1434, the year a Chinese fleet sailed to Italy and ignited the Renaissance. However, by the time Puzina wrote, the tide was already turning against grand synthesizing attempts to link the art of East and West in this way. As the universally skeptical reviews of his book show. Leonardo Olsky began a 1944 article by accepting that, quote, the Oriental influence of Italian art of the Middle Ages and Renaissance has been frequently discussed during the last decades. However, naming and shaming Puzina and his predecessors, he lays into what he calls their fanciful hypotheses, hasty conclusions, systematically demolishing all the examples they provide before stressing, in a possible allusion to Berenson, quote, the vague conformity of some stylistic aspects of early Sienese painting to Chinese art of the Yuan epoch, and the few scattered Asiatic types occasionally represented by Italian painters, cannot compare to the primordial and uninterrupted flow of cultural and artistic ideas from the Near East into the Mediterranean sphere. He attacks Bernard Berenson more directly when he gets to one of the prime and much reproduced examples of supposed Oriental influence, Ambrogio Lorenzetti's fresco of the martyrdom of Franciscan friars in Ceuta, in Siena, much discussed by Puzina on the grounds of what were seen as the East Asian costume and facial features of background figures. Olsky, almost certainly correctly, finds an explanation for Asian facial features in Italian painting, not in the import of Chinese art, for which there remains to this day no evidence at all, or in the return with sketches of Italian sojourners in China, a similarly unsubstantiated claim, but in the ethnic diversity of medieval Italy and the presence there of large numbers of Asian slaves. Olsky's article has often been cited and seems to have largely killed off the issues of Chinese influence on Renaissance art, at least in respectable art historical circles. And this once hotly debated topic has lost its claim on the attentions of the wider field. Also somewhat moribund, it seems to me, is the argument about whether the presence of Western print culture in late Ming China, for which this pair of images with their shared bird's eye viewpoint is Exhibit A, whether that presence sparked new modes of picturing in the latter setting in Ming China. But diffusionist fantasies aside, material and visual culture does stand as evidence for the persistence in memory of connections which are no longer active, but certainly not forgotten. This is not just about marginal zones of contact, but about the heart of early modern polities. One striking example in this case might be found in the world of Iranian courtly collecting, in an album of paintings now in Istanbul, in what was once the collection of the Ottoman sultans. This album, on which Professor Roxburgh has worked extensively, and I draw heavily on him here, is known as the Bahram Mirza album, after its first owner, Bahram Mirza, brother to the Safavid Shah Tahmasp of Iran, for whom it was assembled in the years 1554-5. He has a good claim to be better known as the first world history of art. Since addition to a quantity of images from different regions and different periods of the Islamic world, it includes one European piece and a much larger number of pictures from China. Prominent among these are two fragments of an early 15th century work showing a steed and its two attendant grooms painted on silk by an anonymous master of the early Ming imperial court. The picture may have formed part of a diplomatic gift exchange between the Ming emperors of China and the other Eurasian superpower of the day, the Timurid rulers. An inscription in Persian above the heads of the grooms, which presumably dates from the picture's 16th century remounting, reads, "These paintings are from the collection of good works by the Chinese masters." By the time this album was assembled in the mid-16th century, the regular diplomatic intercourse between Ming and Timurid courts, which had lasted from 1387 to 1504, had come to an end, and private trade had slumped accordingly. The Ming and the Iranian Safavids, never mind the Indian Mughals, were undoubtedly much less connected in the 16th and 17th centuries. But this album is evidence for a memory of connection, at least in Safavid courtly circles. The sense that there was a China and that the products of its skilled painters were real things which might be collected and appraised in the present. It will be universally recognised that the century from 1500 to 1600, during which these Chinese paintings were pasted in this Persian album, was one in which a number of regions of the world became more closely connected with one another through both trade and conquest. And one in which consequently, if paradoxically, many key ideas of difference, of what separates a number of versions of us from a number of thems, first came into being. I find myself unable to agree with my art historical colleague David Carrier in his claim that the 16th century saw coming together and that, quote, "soon after 1522, one unified art world began to be created." Sympathetic as one might be to the generosity of vision this implies, there's equally a contrary view, that this is not the period of a coalescing or of a recognition of unity, but rather is precisely the age in which difference came to be installed as central to the meaning of what this new thing of painting as an art was to be. The 16th century was arguably the beginnings of the modern world in a much less benign sense than is sometimes invoked, above all in its recognition that they are not us. Now, this should remind us, as we discuss the issue of global history and visual culture and the many shifting systems which Sanjay Subramaniam has seen there, that the component parts of those systems, India, China, Southeast Asia, are themselves shifting in definition and in perception as much as in outline. What is connected, if it is more connected, isn't standing still. And the many shifting scholarly systems in which the study of these areas is carried on also needs to be accounted for. It seems to me that those of us in the field of Chinese studies have until recently lagged some way behind other colleagues in an address to integrative or connected histories. It's not so much that we've refused to accept their existence, but that in coming late to this topic, we've perhaps been enthralled by the possibilities they offer for escape from a too strictly bounded Chinese exceptionalism. And it's even possibly that we've leaned too far in the other direction, to the point where the many crucial but utterly unconnected manifestations of the past come to seem dangerously sinological and inward-looking. Are there then aspects of Chinese visual culture which we point to as distinctively lacking a global dimension? One obvious place to look for the limits of portability might be in the products of the elite brush, and in particular in language, in the high status of calligraphy in China, which despite its role in the Sinophone world of Korea and Japan and Vietnam, presumably did not make the transition to acceptance at the other end of Eurasia. Even here, though, the unreadable is no less visual, and perhaps it's even more so. And we see the fascination with Chinese script both in the fantasies of Athanasius Kircher and in this portrait of Thomas Hyde, the first and so far only Orientalist to hold the position of Bodley's librarian in early modern Oxford, and who chose to be pictured with a scroll of the Chinese writing which fascinated him, but which he couldn't read. But this writing often came to Western savants in fairly shabby or at least non-elite forms. For example, in the imitation lacquer decoration of the Danish Royal Palace of Rosenborg from the 1660s, which can be shown to take not just some of its imagery, but also its faithfully copied Chinese characters from a pretty cheap and popular copy of a Chinese novel which found its way via the global book trade into the Royal Library at some point in the early 17th century. Script here is certainly visual cultural communication, much as I've argued elsewhere that the porcelains made in Ming China with Arabic inscriptions may not have been destined solely for Muslim clients, which is the traditional explanation, but may have fed an educated taste in foreign scripts. An exhibition on early Ming China held at the British Museum in 2014-15, for which I served as co-curator, had as one of its central aims the bringing before a wide public of the recent revolution in scholarly perception of at least the early Ming, which sees it not as some nativist reaction to the Mongol conquest pulling down the shutters on the outside world, and I'm quoting from a standard textbook here which describes it, which says, a turning away from the outside world which was accompanied by a growing introspection within Chinese life, which sees it not that way, but rather as to a significant degree another Chinggisid successor state captured by the cosmopolitan glamour of Mongol hegemony. It's to avoid any hint of this introspection that Chinese studies as a discipline has perhaps become rather overexcited about connectivity, but this may well be a necessary corrective phase, corrective to both the Hegelian and Cold War discourses of China's indifference to the wider world. So if in fact there's not one system, but many shifting systems in the history of Asia, it remains the case that some are remembered after the shifts which decentralize them, and some are less remembered or not remembered at all. There's no necessity for the participants in what are in fact connected systems to have any consciousness of each other. Thus, the huge spike in the price of pepper on European markets between 1410 and 1414, which for instance saw the price of pepper in England increase eightfold from 1410 to 1411, this has been attributed by economic historians to the huge amounts of the spice purchased or extorted by the fleets of Admiral Zheng He at precisely this time. The steward in an English medieval aristocratic household fretting about the huge rise in the price of pepper will have been totally unaware of its ultimate causes in Ming imperial policy, in much the same way as thieves today targeting the copper wire of the contemporary British railway system or stealing the lead off church roofs will not necessarily be familiar with the role of China's economic growth in setting current global commodity prices. So, do surviving artifacts of visual culture, however, perhaps point to types of awareness of connectivity which the written record occludes? A painting from around 1600, which shows the urban scene of the Ming secondary capital in Nanjing, pictures the numerous shop signs of its bustling streets, one of which advertises very clearly all sorts of foreign goods available from both the Eastern and Western oceans. The existence of specialist shops for imported exotica from far away, to match those of the Chinamen of 18th century London, suggests perhaps that some sort of awareness of connectedness through oceanic trade existed in the minds of those on the streets of Ming capitals. These might be elite figures like the diarist Li Ruhua, who records purchases of Japanese lacquer and metalwork. And it's worth remembering that Japanese screens and swords were also popular among the tastemakers of Ming China. But he also records what may well have been vessels of Islamic or even Venetian glass, and even on one occasion an ostrich egg from distant Africa, which must have involved Portuguese intermediaries at one point. So Li's awareness of oceanic geopolitics, especially of the conflict between Dutch and Portuguese over the profits of trade with the Ming, was matched by an exposure to its actual products and the visuality they materialized. It wasn't just things, but also technology transfers, which provided the locus through which systems of connectivity made and remade themselves. This remaking could be a very rapid process. A recent essay by Tonio Andrade makes the convincing case that it was the extreme speed with which Chinese military forces adopted the firearms technology of their Portuguese adversaries, which turned an advantage for the Europeans in an initial 1521 armed clash into a much more level playing field by as early as the following year, when Chinese forces prevailed against their European enemies. And later on in the 16th century, the adoption by China of New World food crops, most particularly of maize, but also of chilies, peanuts, or tomatoes, was an event of equally, if not substantial, moment in China's recent history. Just try imagining Chinese food without chilies. But in this instance, the names for the things retained no trace of their foreign origins, as they were adapted and naturalized in both new cultural and horticultural contexts. Nor do any of these things enter visual culture, or at least as it comes down to us today. I'm not aware of any Chinese painting of a tomato or of maize or chilies. The Ming state's abandonment of the major oceanic voyages, whether on the grounds of unsustainable cost or because the issues of shaky legitimacy which they were designed to address had been successfully overcome, provide one of the great what-ifs for contrafactual historians and fictions alike. But it can be demonstrated that Zheng He was never forgotten in China, and it's certainly true that the quantity of geographical knowledge which survived the deliberate destruction of official records of the voyages at the hand of the Ming state may be greater than we imagine. Thus, both the Lord Rutter and the Selden map, unique items coincidentally preserved in Oxford's Bodleian Library, contain evidence for commercially based memories of where Zheng He had gone and what he'd done long after Chinese sea captains themselves had given up sailing further west than Malacca. The Selden map, studied in detail by Timothy Brooke, who places its creation around 1608, is unique in that it turns actual sailing routes into visual culture, stretching from more than one port in China, southeast as far as the Moluccas, and west to the northern end of the Malacca Strait. The very left edge of the map does identify one port, however, as Goli, Calicut, or the modern Kozhikode, the crucial nodal point where Eastern Indian Ocean and Western Indian Ocean networks intersected. It had been one of the key destinations of the Zheng He voyages, its rulers, whether willingly or not, entering, as we shall see, into the network of courtly gift exchange with the Ming emperors through the exchange of precious products. And it's to those gift exchanges in the Indian Ocean world of the early modern, in the 15th century, which I want to go back to now. The distinctive visual and material culture of golden gems. And I want to do this by taking a closer look at exactly what items of what types are found in the extraordinary complex of objects from the tomb of Zhu Jianji, ninth son of the fourth Ming Emperor, first and last Prince of Liang, who was buried with a lavish suite of grave goods in 1441. This princely tomb contains 111 items inlaid with some 18 different types of precious stones, numbering 772 gems in all. None of the stones have been cut, rather they're only polished, but they include some gems of particularly large size and high quality. The largest single group of stones is the rubies, of which there are 175. They're opposed to 147 sapphires and 52 turquoise. There are no diamonds. Rubies also predominate among the loose stones, 17 of which display the seductive red gleam of this rarest of the four major gemstone types. It's jewellery and items of personal adornment which form the great majority of the objects inlaid with gems in the tomb, although it's clear that in this period it was also the practice on occasion to inlay vessels and objects, not just jewellery of various kinds. So given their numerical and visual predominance in the Prince Zhuang of Liang tomb, and note, for example, their centrality in each plaque of the great gold filigree belt, which I'll come back to, I choose to concentrate on the rubies. But where did they come from? China is generally poorly supplied with the major types of gemstone, which have traditionally been found outside its borders. Rubies are mined today and have been mined for centuries in a relatively limited number of places. Closest geographically to the Ming borders are the particularly prolific ruby mines of Mogok, now in northern Burma, but in the early 15th century controlled by the Shan state of Mongmit. And this was a trade which was controlled on the Chinese side by supervising eunuchs, but partly also was in the hands of Chinese private traders who ventured into the Shan regions. But it seems to have flourished only after 1450. Jeff Wade's exhaustive coverage of references to Southeast Asia in the Ming records shows almost nothing in the way of gems arriving as tribute overland from the Shan states before that date. We do hear in Chinese sources of envoys from Sulu, Malacca, and Thailand presenting precious stones, but it may well be that so-called tribute was not the principal route by which rubies got into China. Of course, the rubies in the Prince Zhuang of Liang belt may indeed have come from the Mogok mines, but if they did so, they're much more likely to have come from intermediaries elsewhere. Gems are, above all, supremely portable. The chronicler of the Zheng He voyages, Ma Huan, tells us that in Java, gold, all kinds of precious stones, and all varieties of foreign goods are sold in great profusion. Java was a point of trade, not a point of gem production, a port of trade, and his note demonstrates merely that Chinese private or court-sponsored agents didn't have to go directly to the mines to get the stones. An equally or even more likely source of rubies for the early Ming court was the island of Sri Lanka, a crucial point of intersection, and a land of semi-mythical riches, identified, for example, by Arab writers as the original source of Eden, and by the Venetian traveller Niccolò de Conti, who was in Asia at the very time of the Zheng He voyages, as a particularly rich source of gems. At least five missions from Sri Lankan monarchs to the Ming took place between 1416 and 1459, and the island was the site of one of Zheng He's most forceful interventions, testified to on the gold stele inscriptions. Sri Lanka is the subject of the longest single gem-related passage in Ma Huan's text, Overall Survey of the Ocean Shores, where he writes apropos of the mountains at the side of the king's residence, quote, "The interior of the mountain produces red Yagu, blue Yagu, yellow Yagu, blue Milan stones, Silani, Kumolan, and other such stones. They have each and every precious stone. Whenever heavy rain occurs, the water rushes out of the earth and flows down amidst the sand. They search for and collect the stones, and that is how they get them. There's a common saying that the precious stones are in truth the crystallized tears of Buddha the Patriarch." Now, what's important to note in the early Ming context is that this terminology is not in origin Chinese, but is borrowed from more distant languages as part of the interaction of Arab, Persian, and Mongol vocabularies with Chinese, attendant on the Chinggisid hegemony in Eurasia. The Chinese Yagu is from the Arabic Yakut and is seen as a word first appearing in a 14th century text in a discussion of what are called various kinds of Muslim stones, Huihui Shitou. Despite the fact that this source does discuss other types of red stones, it still seems likely that a red yagu is what we today are calling a ruby or a spinel. They were, on Ma Huan's testimony, available at many points on the Indian Ocean littoral. At Hormuz, on the Persian Gulf, there were red yagu, but also red la, which one commentator identifies as the Persian word lal, meaning the balas ruby or spinel. Spinels were mined at Badakhshan, which straddles the modern Afghan-Tajik border, and was within the Timurid Empire. Badakhshan is almost certainly the source of the magnificent spinel stone in the British Crown Jewels, known romantically since the early 19th century as the Black Prince's Ruby. There's no direct evidence for gems as part of the tribute brought by any of the 78 official Timurid missions to the Ming court between 1387 and 1504. However, as in the case of the rubies of Mogok, this does not mean that the spinels of Badakhshan did not make their way by other means into the Ming Empire, and the Timurid connection is certainly an important one. If we turn from issues of supply to those of consumption, we might ask, what do gems mean as a part of visual culture in the Ming conquest? In her magisterial cultural history of gemstones and jewellery in the early modern West, the art historian Marcia Poynton has written, "Jewellery exists both as a unique material manifestation that blends the natural world with the skill and ingenuity of human endeavour, and as ideas circulated and debated. It acts as a means of conveying what is most precious in a non-material as well as a material sense." For China, we've barely begun to think about these issues, and the literature on gems is very meagre in comparison with the work given to the cultural value of, for example, jade. So what follows is very speculative. We might begin by asking, to what extent were gems important because they came from outside the Ming? Like the appearance of a tribute qilin as a gift from the Sultan of Bengal, they partake of the concept of rui, that is, the numinous or auspicious aspect of unusual phenomena. This is particularly so in the case of rubies, in that they seem to have a rather limited history in China prior to the 14th century, when they appear bearing a foreign name and trailing all the allure of the exotic. However, they predominate visually in the Ming material from the half century 1400 to 1500. And as we've seen, they're numerically the largest single group of stones in the Prince Zhuang of Liang tomb. Does this prominence relate simply to more copious sources of supply at this time, following on from the exploitation of both land and sea routes of engagement with the rest of Eurasia? Or does it relate to changed tastes for the visual and the material on the part of the Chinese elites, tastes which they might have been shared with contemporaries elsewhere? It certainly seems to be the case that there was something of a craze for rubies, for gems of a predominantly red hue, in many of the courts of Eurasia in the 14th and early 15th centuries. Rashid al-Din describes the garden laid out by the Ilkhanid Ghazan Khan near Tabriz in 1302 with its golden throne inlaid with rubies and other gems. In the same part of the world a century later, rubies and spinels were to be the Timurid gem par excellence, as when the gardens of the Emir Timur himself were described in terms where, I quote, "Highland and lowland, steppe and plain were turned into pleasure parks like the gardens of paradise. Forage herbs became tulips, stones became rubies and pearls, grass became elixir, and the ground became gold." A Castilian ambassador in Samarkand in 1403 is our source for the observation that Timur wore on his head a tall white hat on the crown of which was displayed a balas ruby. For the Mughal India's rulers of India in later centuries, rubies were a key sign of their Timurid ancestry, and inscribed gems, several of which survive today, were avidly sought out by them in Iran. In Europe, at this same time, as well as the possible case of the Black Prince ruby noted above, rubies glitter prominently in the earliest surviving crown of an English queen, the so-called Bohemian or Palatine crown, attested as part of the English crown jewels in 1399. They appear in a Burgundian golden ruby badge showing the pelican in her piety, as well as on the breast of the Duke of Milan, Galeazzo Maria Sforza, whose favourite red gems all had their own nicknames. So I'm leaning on the evidence here, but to postulate the sense of a gold and gems combination, with rubies, the rarest of the major four gem types, particularly prominent. I'm positing this as one element of a pan-Eurasian high elite material and visual culture, to set alongside, for example, the taste for fine horses, hunting hounds, and trained raptors. In his 15th century overall survey of the ocean shores by Ma Huan, we learn how the king of Calicut, quote, wished to send tribute, so he took 50 ounces of fine red gold and ordered the foreign craftsmen to draw it out into gold threads as fine as a hair. These were strung together to form a ribbon, which was made into a jeweled girdle with incrustations of all kinds of precious stones and large pearls. So to what extent had such a golden gems aesthetic become a broadly understood visual language of grandeur and status in a range of post-Mongol polities? 200 years later, when the Selden map was drawn, no Chinese ships of any kind, and certainly not the imposing fleets of the early Ming, ever put in at Calicut. However, as Brooke has shown, a colophon on the map indicates that an awareness of its importance and its role as a jumping-off point for voyages to destinations much further west survived at least two centuries after the peak of Ming imperial intervention in the area. Thus, a memory of the connection between China and the Persian Gulf does persist in this unique manuscript source. But who's to say that it doesn't represent what was once a much more widely distributed body of knowledge, which the enormous Chinese textual record, so heavy on the concerns of certain elites and so deficient in those of others, particularly mercantile ones, simply didn't care to preserve and transmit. Given the lack of direct contact between them after the early 15th century, were the Indian Ocean and the Sinosphere then totally separate? Or does this persistence of the former in the memory of the latter, and probably vice versa as well, mean that a collection remains? It seems to come down to the degree to which an awareness, as mediated through material and visual culture, can be thought of to equate to a significance. No Japanese visitor set foot in China for centuries after the early 17th century Tokugawa state's policy of closing the nation, but surely no one would argue that this meant that China had ceased to matter in Japan, for it surely did so, not only to Japanese intellectuals who eagerly consumed its imported products, but to a much wider and more diverse audience of urban and aristocratic consumers as well. Yet even then there were limits. No Chinese painter had a bigger reputation in Japan than the great literary authority of the early 17th century, Dong Zhichang. It was certainly possible in Tokugawa Japan to buy a book telling you what a generic Dong Zhichang painting ought to look like. Yet there was not a single genuine work in the whole country, and this remained the case till the late 19th century. Here the encounter was vast at the psychological level, but the things themselves didn't accompany it. These were things which perhaps should have travelled, but didn't. Here is a picture which shouldn't have travelled, but did. In 1797, the English writing master William Butler acquired a Chinese painting whose import he cannot possibly have known. It was the first identifiable Chinese old master painting to reach Europe, a work by the 14th century artist Xie Chufang. The idea of a flood of Chinese paintings pouring into Trecento, Italy, in the wake of the Mongol conquests is a European fantasy. But here is hard evidence for a Chinese picture, one with an extensive inscription which no one could read, making it out of the Chinese art market, where it ought to have had considerable value. It did so in the very same year, 1797, in which Goethe fantasized about a great painting factory by means of totally mechanical operations such as any child can be employed to perform. Now, it's been demonstrated that China, via the industrial techniques of Josiah Wedgwood, played a part in the fabrication of this Enlightenment nightmare, as China came to be seen as the site of the copy par excellence. Thus, the end of the early modern is associated with a repudiation of the sterile, mechanical, false picturing of Asia, even as the actual pace of trade with that region quickened. It was trade which brought fascination of nature to Georgian London, but the contemporary Qing period has long been seen as one marked by a courtly cosmopolitanism, in which the visual and material cultures of the wider world attested to imagined, if not actual, connections at the very apex of the imperium. To just give one example of the kind of careful work which is uncovering previously unsuspected connectivities, Liu Zhi has demonstrated that recent European innovations in natural history, the fruits of the voyages of discovery, were being consumed in China in the century or so after their publication. So the cassowary, an impressively large flightless bird found in New Guinea, was first introduced to European audiences when a specimen was brought to the Netherlands in 1597. Louis XIV got another one in 1617, but the bird died after 4 years and was then dissected by the French anatomist Claude Perrault. It could be demonstrated that his text, his Mémoire pour servir à l'histoire naturelle des animaux, then provided the immediate source for the imperial inscription for the picture of Ermor birds of 1774. In an annotation to one of the poems which the emperor wrote on these natural marvels, he describes the bird's appearance and anatomy and says, "Westerners have an illustrated book which describes this bird's appearance and anatomy in great detail. The king of the Franks ordered the creation and circulation of this book." And this makes it clear, as indeed does the very close correspondence of the texts themselves, that Perrault's volume was available to the Beijing court. So the incorporative aesthetics, not to speak of the incorporative political ideology of the Qing imperial formation, leads to some extremely eloquent images and objects which are increasingly becoming central to our interest of the period and which go way beyond the older formations of China and the West. The courtly interest in fixed point perspective, mediated by Jesuit members of the imperial workshops, has long been a topic of art historical study, but more recent scholarship takes it in a very different direction from merely seeing it as a Chinese response to a set of pictorial conventions, often assumed, if in an unspoken way, to be in some sense more advanced in the pursuit of mimesis, the universal ultimate aim of all picturing in the influential overview of Ernst Gombrich. The sack by British and French troops in 1864 of the Qing Summer Palace destroyed or dispersed a great deal of the imported exotica which were housed there. But there do still survive telling artifacts like the bow cases of the Qianlong Emperor, this supreme talisman in the construction of Manchu identity being covered in a French silk textile. And there are tantalizing hints that this taste for wrapping objects of great symbolic importance in imported textiles may not have been restricted to the imperial court. A surviving volume of the Chunhua era rubbings, a treasure of Chinese calligraphy, the most prestigious of all visual cultural practices, is nevertheless, it doesn't have an imperial provenance, but it's also wrapped in a French 18th century silk. So how are we to understand this practice of covering things we might see as essentially Manchu or Chinese in imported fabrics? And do such material presences speak of any sort of connection in the realm of material culture, or are they more properly to be understood as being a way of keeping connection at bay? In terms of the study of China's past, the advantage of Sanjay Subramaniam's injunction to see Asia not as one but as many while at the same time paying attention to the material and visual traces of connected histories, and the plural here is particularly important, is that it directs our attention to those moments of connection which link the Ming and Qing empires to other parts of the world than simply Europe. Professor Subramaniam's identification of the 13th century as a moment when India and China turned their backs on one another is undoubtedly true in the larger sense, but we still need to factor into the account the 18th century Qing courtly passion for Hindustan jades, so celebrated in the poetry of the Qianlong Emperor, who wrote dozens and dozens of poems on this topic. Work on histoire croisée may not be welcomed everywhere, as those with an investment in the conceptual integrity of Islam, Buddhism, the West, China, are certainly willing to loudly proclaim. Even before the seemingly sudden resurgence of a range of more or less loudly proclaimed nationalisms, Professor Subramaniam rightly drew our attention to the limits of networks and circuits and reminded us that not everything was connected and not all the time. This is undoubtedly true and salutary and worth remembering, particularly by historians of visual culture, who, as I have ventured to show, have long been seduced by this looking a bit like that and by the special objects that travelled far. These things may offer, in the material nature of their visuality and in the visual aspects of their materiality, they may offer a degree, just a slight degree, of resistance to the flat digital visual culture of, for example, the blockbuster TV series on Chinese state television, when a certain look of the past is deployed very specifically in pursuit of contemporary national aims, as with the modern promotion of an Iranic trade-centered picture of the actually rather bellicose Zhonghe voyages, tied to contemporary assertion of rights to the waters of the South China Sea. As Jeremy Edelman has argued in a recent online article, if we're going to muster narratives about the togetherness of strangers near and far, we're going to have to get more global and be more serious about engaging other languages and other ways of telling history. Surely images and objects have a role here. It's recently been put forward that it's the migration of objects, the fact that objects move, and here I would certainly add images, the fact that they move from one culture to another, which plays an important part in the acquisition of that agency, which they are now widely understood as possessing. The sheer fact of material persistence and the study of the way in which an object or image that resulted from a past connection can continue to exist in the physical space as well as in the speech and imagination of those who encounter it, this should, if we call upon our objects in the right way, render them still able to come to our aid and make visual culture not just something to see, but something to think with too. Thank you very much.